Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust. Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. I went to the American Academy of Religion conference last November, and one of the panels I went to was about cognitive science and religion, which, as you might imagine, is kind of a growing, booming field as people look to the secular and in some ways reductionist language of cognitive science in order to understand religious experience, religious behavior, ritual, etc. And, you know, it was a fairly, you know, moderately interesting panel, sort of okay. It's sort of a dull tool in some ways at this point, and it's not always clear why it's not better just to talk about religion in its own terms. But toward the end of the panel, interesting kind of question came up, which is that, you know, a lot of these scientist types were kind of treating the religious groups or the spiritual practitioners, you know, at a distance, where like they're the ones who have supernatural beliefs, and we're the ones who have the scientific language that can help us explain how it is that they have the experiences and the understandings they have. But I raised my hand and I was like, well, yeah, there's a problem here though, is that, you know, for, you know, well over 100 years, you have spiritual practitioners in the West in particular who are actively engaged with the language, the sort of reductionist language of science. You know, it's all in the brain, it's our psychological patterns, there's no mystical reality, there's no ontological reality, and they've been incorporating those ideas or wrestling with those ideas as part of their practice. And I think one of the best examples of that, and it's one that people who don't know anything about the occult would probably be incredibly surprised about, because they tend to think of people who practice magic or divination or, you know, who use tarot cards or create rituals in order to achieve specific effects in their lives are going to be credulous, supernatural, et cetera, et cetera. But it turns out that there's a very interesting vein of modern occult thought and practice that really actively engages, you know, more naturalistic explanations of these phenomena, even as they continue to ramp up and intensify their experiments with occult potential, ritual potential, imaginative experience. And probably the best example, certainly the most famous or the most notorious, is Aleister Crowley. Again, people think of him, oh, this great, you know, must be a complete madman, supernaturalist, believing in all these ghosts and demons and deities and higher powers and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, to some degree that's true, but there's a very strong vein in Aleister Crowley's work going back to his, some of his earliest works, where he's actively engaging psychology, and in one book he sort of just declares that the phenomena of magic, these spirits that will appear in the magician's triangle, where he's creating, evoking or invoking these entities, and he says, well, these are all just parts of the human brain. So he had a way of experiencing and exploring magic that had kind of one foot in the naturalistic world, and the other foot was definitely deep in the supernatural as well. But that dialectic is really key. I think it's really significant, and that's one of the reasons we talk about magic a lot on this show, both stage magic and occult magic, is it's by paying attention to it, by looking closely at it, you get to start to see some of the big issues surrounding the relationship of the brain and the mind, the soul, and this very, very natural DNA machine body that we carry around. And so, and some of my thoughts around these topics have definitely been enriched by conversations with our guest today, Jeremy Glick, a friend of mine from the Bay Area who has just gotten his PhD in cognitive psychology from Stanford and has lots of interesting things to say about these matters. But before we bring Jeremy on, just want to, of course, invoke our co-host, Maja Daou. Maja, is it invoking or evoking? I always get that confused.
Invoke is when you say with words. Invocation is when you actually make it vocal. And evoke is when you kind of draw it out, like, emotionally. But you can evoke me by invoking me.
Wonderful. Either way, you have arrived. I'm kind of curious. You know, given the talks you give and these lectures and the PRS and all this stuff, that you've gotten to see a lot of magic users and people interested in the occult and alchemists, and you've met a lot of these characters. What would you say is sort of the percentage, or how frequently you come across people who, even as they're exploring really way out ideas and possibilities, also really have an active interest in more secular ways of describing these phenomena, whether it's psychology or neurology those kind of more grounded, if you will, explanations?
Man, it's got to be at least 70%. It's more than half, you know? I've met people, a lot of folks that come in will be doctors, scientists. I got a couple rocket science dudes from JPL, you know? And, they're out there, these people that are combining them. It's not just a bunch of floozies that are just, you know, kind of randomly taking drugs and finding out this stuff. There's a lot of people that are including the more, like you said, grounded aspect of it. And I think, like, a lot of people, like you said, like a lot of the scientists get real, like, oh, well, we can explain this, so we don't really care about the supernatural. But what I find is a lot of the scientists are like, well, we can see, like, a physical, biological explanation for this, but what is that for? Like, what does that mean, that there is this biological thing happening? Like, what can we do with that? And that's what I find the people that are combining it are trying to check out more.
Yeah, how they interact. Well, that's a wonderful introduction to our guest, Jeremy. Thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind. Do we have you there?
Yep. Yeah, I'm right here.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah. We took a moment for the invocation to work on the circuit loop. So thanks a lot for being there. And I know you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Your email that you're just in the process of getting a job after, you know, finally getting your PhD, and I hope that's going well.
I am.
Did you make a decision?
Yes, I made a decision. I'm going to be going and working for a large company with a mouse on the front, doing data analysis for some of their social games.
Very interesting. Yeah, I know. I mean, we're definitely going to be talking about gaming some, and one of my favorite phrases actually comes from the whole Disney empire, is this notion of the Imagineer. And I often actually think about certainly aspects of occult practice and ideas as precisely imagineering, in the sense that there's very much a kind of technical aspect, a sort of setup, a way of using symbols and signs and ritual diagrams to sort of, almost to treat the potentials of the mind as a kind of technology. But that technology, instead of linking to some obviously objective goal, is sort of bound up with the imagination and what the potentials of the imagination are. So I think that's a pretty charming place for you to land after, getting your PhD from the Beast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a funny coincidence. So they've actually hired several other PhDs from the department already for this kind of position. So clearly we have something that they want.
Cool. Well, what I'd like to start out about, I mean, just because we've talked before, I know a little bit about your background. Oftentimes in the show we like to ask people kind of where they first started getting going in their interests. And I really liked the picture you drew for me once of you, not literally, but of your high school experience, because I know in my experience, you know, where my mind went when I was 12, 13, 14 years old was very, very powerful, very, very important on a lot of the stuff that I ended up working on later in life. And it's also a place often where people young lions kind of get into the occult, and they get into the imagination, they get into games, and they do it in a different kind of way than I think we do maybe later on in life. And I know that you were deep in, and so I just love to hear a little bit about what your world was like when you first really started to get into this stuff.
Sure. So I, through high school, through middle and high school, was a nerd and a geek, and this brings with it a kind of mutually supporting cluster of interests, including fantasy and science fiction literature and pencil and paper role playing, and for me, Japanese RPGs on the console systems, and all of these kinds of things. So when I was 16, at some point, I started reading some online text files from an archive largely of bulletin board posts on the internet at that time, which, of course, this was well after the web was going and bulletin boards were not really the going thing anymore for the most part. But these posts were archived, and it was a set of Chaos Magic texts. Though I limited myself to reading them until right around my 17th birthday, because that's when my journal entries start. That said, the first ritual that I ever actually remember performing is a bit older than that, a bit before that. I don't know how old I was, but there is a Calvin and Hobbes strip where Calvin attempts to invoke snow. He recites a snow prayer and does a snow dance and attempts to create a snow day. And I tried something like that at some point. Skeptical solecism camp at that point, and Chaos, of course, goes right along with that position. I had not terribly long before that gotten into H.P. Lovecraft, and of course that is a very popular source of inspiration among chaotes, whether or not they actually do anything with it. And I don't know. I did a lot of camping growing up. My parents liked to do that as a family vacation, but somehow the kind of outside styles of pagan practice were not really appealing to me at that time in my life. And so Chaos was, nicely indoors, and you could do it with whatever you had to hand. You didn't have to worry about going and getting anything complicated, or you didn't need to worry about acquiring and reading any specific books before you could move on. So I was able to just use whatever I was able to get my hands on without really needing to, for example, talk to my parents about it.
Right. Well, one of the things I think is that the important connections you make there is that philosophical position that you had. And again, that's, I think, something that's surprising to people who aren't familiar with the flows and shapes of contemporary magic, is just how much, particularly in Chaos Magic, it incorporates a kind of active, people that'll take different forms or different people, but a kind of skepticism, a kind of naturalism, certainly a resistance to what you might call religious ways of thinking about the forces and entities that you're dealing with, even in contrast with other kinds of pagan practice. And it seemed like for you that was definitely, part of what interests me about your work and your course in life is the way that you kind of kept, going in a way with, naturalist explanations, with the world of, moving into cognitive psychology and really trying to understand in scientific terms how we organize things and sort of bringing that information to bear on what was also your continued interest in the exploration of the imaginal. So, I mean, how did those things kind of go together with you as you went through, you moved through college and you kind of started to get drawn towards the science you had studied?
Sure. I have to credit Chaos with several things, even though I've moved away from it, not least of which is my choice of college major. I was applying to several colleges, of course, and two of the ones that I was considering most strongly were Vassar College, which some of the listeners might know, was once a women's college and went co-ed in, I believe, the late 60s. It turns out that I'm a legacy, actually. My grandmother went there, and so did her mother, and so did her mother, which is something that I didn't know until I was actively applying for colleges, and somebody mentioned that, and that caused me to take a look. And Vassar is where I ended up going, and Vassar has an excellent undergraduate cognitive science program. So I saw this. What I saw was the symbolic systems program at Stanford, which is kind of their equivalent to cognitive science, at least at the undergraduate level. And I saw at Vassar that, oh, you can put together your own major. Oh, I can put together the symbolic systems thing here instead. And then I realized, oh, they have this. It's called cognitive science. And that is, in fact, what I ended up majoring in at Vassar, alongside mathematics, which was more of an inertia thing. Math classes were the most like high school classes of all my college classes, so in some ways it was comfortable to take one every quarter, and then I ended up having a major in it.
Let's unpack that term symbol systems a little bit, because that seems to be one of those overlaps where mathematics and occult and cog-sci models, there's a certain kind of overlap in just what symbol systems are.
That's right, and I think that's what originally caught my attention was the name of that program. I'm not sure that I would have initially looked quite as hard at cognitive science if I hadn't first been exposed to it through the form of this program called Symbolic Systems. Because, of course, Chaos talks a lot about manipulating symbols in a relatively many times content-free kind of way, or at least content-interchangeable kind of way, where you can perform the same kinds of manipulations with symbols that refer to different things at different times and change what those references are pretty much at whim, or at least that's part of the goal of that practice. Stanford SimSys program is a little bit heavier on the artificial intelligence, a little bit heavier on the linguistics than Vassar's cognitive science program, which is more on the psychology end of things. But all of these are kind of under the umbrella of the cognitive sciences nowadays. Anything that involves agents behaving in an environment, but also kind of abstract manipulation of symbols, and you get both of these in linguistics, you get both of these in artificial intelligence and robotics, you get all of these across the whole spectrum of psychology, psychology of religion, what's called experimental philosophy, where you run experiments to see how people actually solve philosophical problems in practice. It tends to be a lot of questionnaires and surveys.
Did you find, with a lot of other people that you've kind of worked with, is there a pretty big divide between, the cognitive scientists in terms of, neurobiology and the psychologists? Or do you find there's a lot of cognitive scientists that do, study a lot of the psychology behind it, not just the actual physical chemical stuff?
The Cognitive Science Society and its conference is actually dominated by psychologists.
Oh, okay.
And psychology is kind of, as far as I can tell, the dominant, although not overwhelmingly so, discipline in the cognitive sciences. Though that's more and more being supplanted by neuroscience. But even that is largely cognitive neuroscience. So it tends to be a lot of neuroimaging of the brain as it's doing things. And the things that it's doing are usually one or another psychology experiment, but in an MRI tube.
From doing that kind of perspective, what's your sort of short way of describing how these symbolic systems and investigating them helps us understand what's actually happening when people have powerful magical experiences?
That is a tough one. I will say that obviously the way that I ended up engaging with cognitive science ended up not being the way that I was expecting that to interface with my magical practice, in as much as it caused me to move away from chaos, because I ended up basically moving away from the solipsism and also from this idea of belief itself as being the dominant construct in magical practice, which is a very chaos kind of thing to do, is say that what matters is that you, in the moment, are able to strongly believe in something. Whereas I decided that, in fact, magical practice is more complicated than that, and there's a whole host of factors that end up playing a role in what it, how it plays itself out in lived experience.
Well, can you talk about that? Unpack some of that.
Sure. So there unfortunately isn't, I would say, all that much work in the cognitive sciences that I'm really satisfied with in this direction. There are some starts. So, for example, Harvey Whitehouse has his work on, doctrinal and imagistic religions, I believe. And he's anthropologist of religion, perhaps. But he's there in the cognitive psychology of religion. And the idea is that religious experience tends to be dominated by two modes, one of which is kind of literate, where you've got a text and you go through it a bunch of times, and the text kind of impresses itself on you. And the other being this imagistic mode, where instead of going through any kind of text or experience, ritual experience, multiple times in pretty much the same way each time, you go through each one kind of once. And it's a totally unique experience, but it creates such an impression on you that you then are able to, in some kind of sense, recreate that for the next person who goes through that ritual, even if it's not exactly the same experience. And I find a lot of magical practice interesting in the extent to which it bridges between these two modes, because a lot of really effective magical ritual, I would say, is very heavily textual, right? You're trying to do things out of books that are kind of as old as you can get them in a lot of traditions. But on the other hand, you're really trying to hit this imagistic side of things as hard as you can, even if you're following a ritual exactly as it's written down. It's not enough just to go through it a whole bunch of times. You really need to feel it the first time, or the one time that matters.
Yeah, in a way, that's kind of like the Imagineering frame that I talked about. If you can really look at texts, writing, and especially once you get into grimoires and you get into rituals as kind of algorithms, that they're really providing a certain kind of, just a way to do things, a sort of framework, a kind of logistics. But by linking it to the image, you get this very different mix than you would in a straight sort of just text-based, liturgical, dogmatic kind of environment that we find in more conventional idea of what religion is.
That's right. Similarly, I've tended to bring into my understanding of magical practice a lot of bits of psychology that might not immediately be thought of as relevant. And I would say that one of the really big ones here is expertise effects. So we're looking at Anders Ericsson's work about, the whole 10,000 hours thing, and how much and what kind of practice is necessary to become a skilled expert in some kind of practice. And this is pretty general, and I think it applies just as well to magical ritual as it does to playing the violin or to memorizing groups of numbers.
Is this about how oneself becomes more of an expert, or how you sort of deal with other people who are sort of sociologically considered experts, like the person who teaches you the ritual? Which kind of expertise are you talking about?
This is the first one, where how do you yourself become an expert? And the answer is lots and lots of practice, and it's practice of a particular kind, which is deliberative practice, where you're really attending to what you're doing in a particular kind of way.
Concentration practice, basically.
It's not simply that, because another important aspect to deliberative practice is that you fail a lot, and that you pay attention to how you're failing, which, of course, in some ways goes against what I just said about magical ritual needing to work really well the one time that you do it, you do need to go through and practice doing it a lot, which makes it sound more like White House's doctrinal kinds of things, and that you're going through the same text over and over. But I don't think it's going through the same text for going through the text. It's for noticing how the performance of that ritual text affects you and those around you, if there are any people around you when you're doing it, and paying strong attention to that kind of thing for building up ritual skills. Now, for dealing with other kinds of experts, that's another really interesting idea, and then we get into a lot of what I would think of as kind of social, what often turn into problems in magical practice around people trying to get personal power by way of appearing to be an expert to other people.
Yeah. No, that's in a way that's a more familiar story about how people deploy authority, and then people, you know, want somebody else to be the authority, or they don't, and then they, but they're sort of drawn into their, you know, spell, if you will, of personal charisma. But the point you're talking about is really, it's almost like what kind of process you go through at the end of which you grant yourself a kind of authority based on the amount of practice that you've done in this kind of, you know, iterative way. It's a very interesting. What is there another example of something that you kind of brought from your psychological studies that's sort of less predictable or more unusual in terms of thinking about the occult?
Yeah, I think that I can probably pull out numerous examples, though maybe a lot of them aren't terribly explicit. But I think one of the big ones is kind of this twofold thing. First, in thinking about how metaphors shape our experience of our lived experiences and our understanding of what it is that we are experiencing. So there's this general framework within which the metaphors that we have affect what we think is going on, our interpretation of the situation, and actually at a fairly deep level. And then simultaneously, I think that I've drawn from my particular kind of style of psychology, the traditions in which I was trained in psychology, a particular set of metaphors that have really helped to shape how I understand magic. So I have both these metaphors and the tools for thinking about how those metaphors affect me. And I can talk about either one of those.
Sure. No, there's a lot here. But, you know, I think we will take a break here because there's a lot of good stuff. But we always step away from messages. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking to Jeremy Glick, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis talking to Jeremy Glick. We're talking about magic and mind games and psychology and all that fun stuff. And I know, Jeremy, you were about to kind of springboard into some stuff before the break, but I had a question about something you mentioned before. You said that you had come to a point where you had split from solipsism, which sounds like was kind of a route for you that attracted you to maybe some of this stuff in the first place, and that you were veering a little more away from chaos magic, if I'm not mistaken. And I was curious, I know solipsism is kind of the view that you are the, not really center of the universe, but kind of that you create the world and it's from your own thoughts and that everyone else is kind of a construct of that. And I was just curious, did you veer away from that because you had maybe like a more mystical experience where you felt a connection from other people, or what was kind of the root of your split there?
There was an important mystical experience, so it predated that split by a couple of years. I would say that the split was largely due to a revision in the philosophical views that I had, and that was due largely not to, for example, taking philosophy classes in college. This split happened when I was in college. But more to actually the cognitive science and psychology end of things. I ended up realizing that a lot of the metaphors for mind that that occur in the chaos texts weren't satisfying to me. And furthermore, that what we are as cognitive beings seems to be extremely heavily shaped by the world that we live in. I kind of ended up concluding that the world, that there has to be a world out there, that the world is prior. And as a corollary to that, I'm not smart enough to have been able to think up everything that's going on around me. So it must come from somewhere else. And so I moved into this way of thinking about things as very much embodied. So I'm a psychologist. We might think that I would be thinking all day about what's going on in the brain at some level, and that's pretty much accurate. But I don't think it's accurate, in fact, to say that it is all in the brain, or even all in the nervous system, because so much of what we are as thinking beings is heavily constrained, almost shaped or even almost determined by what we are as physical beings and the world that we live in as a physical world, at a minimum. Whether or not we're going to say anything else about what might be going on besides the brain, at a minimum there's also a body and an environment.
Well, because it's interesting, I feel like that's a really important issue and split with a lot of occultists and scientists for that issue, right? It's like, is it on the inside or is it the outside? Like a lot of magicians or occultists feel like what they do in their mind is controlling the world or whatever. But then there's this whole school of kind of the more Taoist magicians. They're like, no, it's an interaction, and what happens on the outside is connected to what's happening inside, not just in a purely solipsistic way. So to me, that's very interesting. And I know like a lot of the psychological occultists, like say Jodorowsky, you know, I don't know if you've read the Psychomagic book at all, but his whole premise is very much like that, using psychology not in a way to kind of like shoot it out of your own brain, but to make those kind of revelations as noticing the connection between the physical, the mental, and the environment, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think that the extent to which any of this purely internal, kind of purely personal, mental kind of inner work functions, it functions because of rather than despite the fact that we are embodied critters. So it's, for example, difficult, or for me I think impossible, to imagine doing any kind of imaginal ritual, right? You have practices where you construct an entire ritual practice and you do it all in your head. But the fact that we're able to do that is just because we're so skilled at moving around in a real physical world that we can actually recreate that in our heads. So that's one way I think that embodiment kind of gets in through the back door, even when we think we're doing something that is purely mental.
So what do you think would be like the most important psychological practice an occultist that wanted to get that connection could do? Like, I know you mentioned like just repetition of a ritual until you really kind of feel it. Do you think that would be like the most important way to like get access to that experience?
My favorite metaphor right now for learning magic is actually learning language. And this is, I of course am not a Chomskyan about language learning. I think that it is a skill, something that is learned, and that the environment is pretty much sufficient for picking it up. I don't really want to unpack that. It's a complicated debate. But what I'm thinking of in terms of language use is that, and I'm thinking like really skilled language use, like good writing or good oratory. Right, is kind of the equivalent to really good ritual. And I think you get that in a couple of different ways, and all of them are necessary. One way that you get them is, of course, just doing spontaneous speech in conversation with others. And I think of that as kind of relatively spontaneous ritual practice, relatively unscripted, but drawing on everything that you've managed to pick up so far about how rituals affect you and whatever sets of correspondences you've managed to build up, and all that kind of thing. And just observing how the universe talks back to you as you're doing those. And this is an interactive dialogue, I think, with your surrounding environment at whatever level, in just the way that you were saying.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful way of saying about it. Just the part of what we appreciate with good oration is this kind of rhetorical flourish. It's the waves of the enunciation. It's that particular word that's both extremely detailed and evocative of a whole set of ideas, the way
Hello?
That a whole network of associations can be...
Hello? Oh, sorry, you cut out for a second. Hello?
Yes?
Sorry, you cut out for a second there. So
I'm sorry, the phone must have cut out. So, I was just saying that the way that the rhetoric works, the way that public speaking, you know, you use phrases in certain ways, just the right set of associations so that you kind of can, pluck the resonating connectors between different kinds of associations to make things thicker and more resonant. I mean, that model of resonance, I think, is a really a key one that works with language. And if you just think about the difference between poetry and prose, especially coming out of someone's mouth when they're just sort of describing something and when it becomes poetic, that difference, which is really hard to explain. You know, literary critics try to do it. It's like, it's very hard to say exactly what that is, but in a way that affects, that kind of goes in a ritual framework as well.
I think that's right. And I think that, perhaps doing this kind of spontaneous ritual is a way of getting you really good at plucking those resonant strings with the environment for yourself. But especially, but not entirely, if you want this to be moving to other people, if you want other people to think that this is good poetry or good rhetoric, I think the other aspect of getting really good at ritual is really learning some good existing ritual. And this, I think, is where some of the older texts come in as kind of models for personal practice in much the same way that we make students read Shakespeare and other great works of prose and poetry. Great partly because they're culturally valued, and I don't necessarily think that the set that we in fact use is optimal in any special way, but also just great because they are very good examples of this linguistic craft, and even if they're not the only such examples that we could be using, they are very good examples. And that helps train one to be able to produce better language, I think.
This is so true. And, I mean, for me personally, it resonates a lot because that's basically what I do. One of the things that I started doing as an extemporaneous ritual is I do these things called oracle performances where I'll get up on the stage and I invite people to just ask me questions about the mysteries of the universe. And it's for, you know, a crowd of people. Sometimes it'll be like in a bar, so I don't know what people are going to say. I have no idea what people are going to ask me. And then I just have to be on my toes and respond in an open manner. So it's a dialogue involving other people where it gets bounced off. I have to draw on my occult knowledge, and before doing it, I researched the Oracle of Delphi and how they would perform the procedure and what they would kind of do to get ready. And I mean, a lot of all those things that I do fits in like exactly with everything that you're saying. It's a oracular response that has to get kind of made in the moment, that is not planned on anything, but then also draws from this constant practice of experience of, you know, giving lectures for years with notes and then having to go up and drop the notes and just kind of do it, on the fly.
I think that's exactly right, yes. So that is basically the metaphor that I'm currently working with for how one becomes a skilled ritualist. And I think both of these are necessary, right? You can't become a great writer just by poring over existing works of great literature and never actually attempting to produce anything yourself. And it's also, I think, quite difficult to become a great orator without at least spending a certain amount of time with some pre-existing works in that craft.
Mm. Well, that's one way. So you step aside from some of the chaos magic approaches, too, is that you recognize that there is this sort of, you know, tradition that goes very far back, that is, you know, very rich, and that in some ways you study it the way you study a canon. If you're a contemporary poet, you're still going to be familiar with Keats or Sappho or whatever, and you might do it in a different way. But it's like part of what you're doing is to kind of keep this this tradition going. There was something else you mentioned in one of your emails that I wanted to ask you about, which is what sort of, you know, since you've studied so much of these, you know, psychological tests and you know, a lot of what you find, when the more you read these findings, you're like, wow, you know, my idea of what I know, how I make decisions, how I construct the world is oftentimes not altogether accurate, or at least there's a lot of other stuff going on that I'm not necessarily aware of. And you mentioned kind of some psychological findings that would be that every occult practitioner should know about. And I think that's a really interesting way of like bringing these two kind of dialogues together a little bit. So what are some examples of things that you've discovered through studying cognitive psychology that sort of you think are particularly important to kind of recognize or wrestle with from the occult practice perspective?
I've thought about possibly trying to do this as a blog, actually, at some point. I think that there's a lot of potential for spelling out a lot of these connections. I would say that one of the big ones is kind of the work on cognitive biases, not because I think that practitioners are necessarily more vulnerable to cognitive biases than other people, but because everybody is prone to cognitive biases, and when magical practitioners fall vulnerable to them, I think it tends to do worse things to them because of the very intense work that they're involved in. There's a huge, as you were saying, literature on what you thought you were doing is not actually what you're doing, and actually what you're doing is something that's kind of strange and maybe not very accurate. And I don't think I can get into the whole list of those. But the one that I would want to highlight here is a kind of a general manifestation of the self-serving bias, which is that individual people can be told about these cognitive biases and say, oh, yes, that makes perfect sense. I see how that works, and I see how it plays out in all these other people, but it doesn't really affect me. And I think it's really important to highlight to people that in fact, it does affect them. And this bias is so strong that you can then present cognitive biases and then present this bias. Okay, people understand cognitive biases, and they furthermore don't think that they're vulnerable to it. And that is a cognitive bias because they're still vulnerable to it. And people will say, oh, yes, I recognize that, but I'm not biased in that way. When I have cognitive biases, I recognize it.
and so it's this
recursive self-serving bias where people just don't want to accept, and this has been an important part of my practices, I think, to realize that I am not special in these ways. Mm. When I see a really well-supported psychological story for what's going on in people's heads, I tend to assume that it applies to me, and I try to watch out for when I might be bitten by it and take explicit steps to correct it. And this, of course, doesn't always work, but I think it is nevertheless an important kind of practice in which to engage.
I realized, you know, the time's flying by as it often does, and I really wanted you to mention something about the art of memory. I mean, it was a huge topic, but it seems like a very interesting example where something that you can, that's part of, you know, psychological discussion about how memory works and how memory can be improved, and people are familiar with these methods that go back for quite a long time, and that are also kind of bound up with the with some magical imagination and magical practice. So that might be a thing for you to describe a little bit about what interested you and what continues to interest you about the art of memory.
Sure. I was actually about to try to springboard into that also. So the art of memory, I tend to think of it actually as arts of memory. There's not really a single monolithic art of memory that subsumes all the others, although there is a particular set of techniques that are used more commonly than the others. Memory art is, in one sense, it's just a really good trick. And it's just a mnemonic trick, but it's a really good one. And it's one where you turn things that you need to remember into images. And these have to be scenes that are kind of like a single scene. So you turn individual things that you want to remember into objects or persons or actions in that scene, but it all has to work together. You can't have one thing happening over here and another thing happening over there with no connection between them. And by connection, I mean a physical connection inside of a scene. So, for example, a man with a stick hitting a dog might represent something. If the stick represents one thing and the man represents another thing, and the dog represents a third thing, that combined action is an image that is much more readily retrievable than a verbal description of what it was that you wanted to remember. And, of course, this goes back at least 2,400 years to Simonides the poet. At least that's the mythic origin of these techniques. And it turns out that in the mid to late 60s and kind of through the 70s, there was a lot of interest in cognitive psychology about these imagery, what they're called imagery mnemonics. Mnemonics because they're techniques for remembering things, and imagery because they work by transforming what you need to remember into images. And then everybody kind of lost interest because, for one thing, these techniques aren't very practical on a day-to-day level for most people because they're work. You actually have to deploy them in the moment when you're trying to remember something that you're going to need to remember later. And that's just too much work for most people. So it's very difficult to get any kind of outcome measurement from these techniques because most people just don't do
too,
them.
Because like some people do have different ways they remember things better. I mean, I know the visualization is a thing. For me, I have a very visual memory. But then I've also talked to people that they have to hear it. Like some people will want books on tape when they're trying to memorize because they have like auditory kind of triggers. So, I mean, do you think there's variation in that, or do you think it's always the image is kind of the best way?
I think that there are modality differences between individuals. So that's definitely true, though I don't think anybody really understands what that means in practice. It definitely seems to be true, but I don't know whether we really understand it.
Well, because I think that really gets to a thing about language, right? I mean, the first written languages were images, they were pictures, they were symbols, but then we also, like, talk to each other, which is, you know, verbal, and the way that people would tell stories was one way to remember, and then the way we had of writing down was with the symbol, you know? So it's like some weird combination of those two things.
That's right. So, and there are some, I swear at some point I read a version of a legend from maybe the last few centuries BCE or the first few centuries CE about memory and language, where one of the pharaohs of Egypt is brought the arts of memory by, I believe, Hermes, and the arts of writing by Thoth. And of course, you often see these as the same figure, right? But here they are standing next to each other, and one of them's presenting memory, and one of them's presenting writing.
Huh.
And the pharaoh says, "Oh, this writing thing is garbage because once you've written something down, you have no need to remember it anymore. It's a trick. It's a toy. It's a substitute for real memory, which is what really matters." And I think certainly for magical ritual practice, that's very true. It's having a table of correspondences sitting next to you, telling you that you know, green is associated with Venus or whatever set of associations you're using, is not the same thing as having those ingrained in your own personal memory to the point where you can look at a green object and see the influence of Venus, right? So I wish I could find that legend. It might be something that I made up, actually, because I think that there is a bit in Plato that's quite like what I just said.
I was going to say, it's not the part in the Phaedrus, I think, where Socrates says, you know, Thoth comes and brings writing, and then they say, oh, this is going to destroy everything. I mean, I don't remember it being specifically linked to the art of memory as like a corresponding art, but there definitely is the idea of memory in that text. But it's totally fascinating stuff. You mentioned also about how you link this idea of image and memory up with remix culture. And we only got a couple of minutes here left. I knew this was going to fly by. We didn't even talk about games. We didn't talk about technology. But maybe, you know, just I'd love to get a little flourish from you about how you kind of see some of this stuff playing out in our contemporary, not just, you know, the magical subculture, but like this, the sort of larger world that we're in with images and networking and all that.
Mary Carruthers has this excellent book called The Book of Memory, which I at least found a fascinating and enjoyable read. It's an academic text, so it might be pretty dense for a lot of people, about the history of the mnemonic practices, specifically through the Middle Ages. One thing that comes out of that is that the extent to which modern scholarship is really dominated by this idea of kind of a textual citation, right? A citation is something where you put down some quote marks and then you put the words, exactly the same words in exactly the same order as they appeared in whatever text you're citing, and then you put the name of the author. And citations didn't used to be like that. Citations were when you repeated the gist of what somebody said, the thing rather than the actual words, you didn't even necessarily cite who said it, because the idea was that a citation was something that you put down that the reader was going to recognize and know what it was that you were referring to. And all of this relied on memory, because, of course, when you were writing, you didn't have these other citations in books open next to you. You didn't go open the book and copy down the citation. You had that book memorized, at least for the gist of it, not for the words, because nobody cared about the sequence of words. And then you put down that gist from your memory and assumed that in the other person's memory it would light up the same cluster of associations from the original author as it does in yours, or maybe a few other words referencing some very famous bit of Homer or whatever source you're trying to link in. And nowadays, if you do that kind of thing, it generally, in an academic sense, gets called plagiarism. And you're seeing this a lot with undergraduate writers who wind up doing what looks a lot to their professors like plagiarism, in terms of dropping in bits of other texts, unsighted, no quotation marks.
It sounds like it's more of a reference to a shared experience, like when someone says jump the shark or something.
And I think that's exactly what's going on, especially in remix culture, because remix culture is all about these shared reference and evoking them within some novel work that says something different, but that says it with reference to one or probably several or possibly very many pre-existing works, most or all of which you expect your listeners to know and recognize.
Right. Well, you know, that's a very evocative or perhaps invocative point. But the time has flown by, so we're going to have to wrap things up here. Jeremy, thanks so much for being with us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was
wonderful.
Really great talk. So, folks, from Eric and Maja to you, keep your minds open.